John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for not, oh no, my phone's just sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is tie is this, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, May the 4th, 2011. Palestinian sources announced on Tuesday afternoon that Palestinian factions have signed the National Reconciliation Deal in Cairo. The Higher Committee for Emergency and Medical Services in Gaza issued a report on Israeli attacks and violations against the Gaza Strip in April, revealing that Israeli soldiers killed 23 Palestinians, including two children, and wounded 81. Egypt's Foreign Minister, Nabil Al-Arabi, met on Tuesday evening with the visiting Hamas delegation, headed by Hamas's political bureau chief, Khalid Mashal, and held talks on the latest developments in the Arab world with the Palestinian Unity Agreement. The Ministry of the Interior in the Gaza Strip announced on Wednesday morning that a resident convicted of collaborating with the Israeli occupation has been executed. A senior Palestinian source reported that the Hamas and Fatah movements agreed that the current Prime Minister in the West Bank, Dr. Salam Fayyad, will not be heading the new interim unity government that will be formed after the unity deal is officially signed. On Wednesday at dawn, Israeli troops abducted four Palestinian residents, including a former minister, in the southern West Bank city of Hebron and the nearby village of Dura. Local sources reported that the soldiers broke into the home of former minister, engineer Issa al-Jarbari, cuffed and blindfolded him before taking him to an unknown destination. In related news, soldiers opened fire at a Palestinian vehicle near the entrance of al-Samoa village near Hebron. Palestinian Prime Minister Dr. Salam Fayyad has demanded that Israel release all tax and revenue money that it has decided to withhold following the signing of the Palestinian Unity Agreement in Cairo. He said that Israel must release the money it decided to withhold, and added that the PA needs this money in order to be able to function and perform its duties. The measure was taken by Israel in an attempt to sabotage the unity agreement between Fatah and Hamas, and the efforts to declare a unity government that includes all factions. The Palestinian Prime Minister stated that he hopes international pressure will be practiced on Israel so that the PA can continue to function properly and meet its obligations. Palestinian news sources report that Israeli settlers assaulted a Palestinian shepherd in the village of Kusra, located near Nablus in the northwest bank, on Wednesday and killed one of his sheep. Palestinian human rights group Adamir has claimed that an Israeli military court order sentencing Palestinian writer Ahmed Qatamish to 6 months of administrative detention appears to have been tampered with. Israeli judicial authorities had indicated that Qatamish was to be released on Tuesday following 13 days of detention in Israel's Ofer jail. But a last-minute order was issued containing inaccurate information, the group said in a statement. Adamir said it had a copy of the order, which disgracefully appears to be a copy of someone else's detention order that has been tampered with to include Mr. Qatamish's name. Jimmy Carter, former President of the United States of America, Hanan Ashwari, a Palestinian negotiator, and Palestinian Prime Minister Salam Fayyad have all welcomed the Palestinian unity deal. Three children have been injured in an explosion in the Tel HaSultan area of Rafah in the Gaza Strip. Investigators believe that an unexploded shell detonated, injuring the three, who were subsequently transferred to Abu Yusuf al-Najjar Hospital. One of the children is expected to lose part of his hand. This rounds up the main news for today. Please join us again tomorrow for a summary of important events in the Palestinian territories. You have been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Center. For more updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by Hussam Qasis and me, David Steele.
The nation and world were caught by surprise on Sunday, May 1st, when President Obama unexpectedly appeared on television networks to announce that a special U.S. Navy SEAL assault team had raided a compound in Pakistan, killing al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden. The news of bin Laden's death came almost 10 years after the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks on New York's World Trade Center towers, the Pentagon, and a crashed airliner in Pennsylvania, resulting in nearly 3,000 deaths. In cities around the country, thousands of Americans took to the streets to cheer the news of Osama bin Laden's death. Mr. Obama told Americans that the world is a better place with the death of bin Laden, even as U.S. intelligence agencies and the military prepared for the possible launch of retaliatory attacks by al-Qaeda supporters. Not long after news of bin Laden's death was announced, some members of the former Bush administration maintained that information used to locate bin Laden was obtained by torture, or what they euphemistically call harsh interrogation techniques, in an attempt to justify the controversial policy, illegal under international law, and later banned by President Obama. The justification of torture was disputed by many, including Senator Dianne Feinstein, chairwoman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, who said that torture of 9/11 suspects did not aid in locating bin Laden. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Mel Goodman, a former CIA analyst, who is now a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and an adjunct professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. Goodman examines how the death of al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden may affect the U.S. war on terrorism and the conflict in Afghanistan.
I think we need to recognize that we dealt al-Qaeda a tremendous setback 10 years ago. When we went into Afghanistan and routed al-Qaeda and ultimately the Taliban, they were really dispersed. And I'm not saying they were rendered harmless in this situation, but I think they lost a lot of ability to conduct the kind of sophisticated operations that 9/11 was all about. 9/11 was an incredible operation with a lot of moving parts. Various countries were involved, Germany and Spain, the United States in terms of training. And I don't think al-Qaeda has that kind of capability anymore. And I don't think bin Laden was the operational leader of al-Qaeda in that sense, because basically he was in retreat. And I think even the fact that he was killed where he was suggests that he was still on the run, probably because of the success of the drone strikes in Waziristan, in western Pakistan. I think I assume the leadership of Al-Qaeda has had to move out of that area. Al-Qaeda people are dying on a regular basis because they're consistently being targeted. I think one of the questions it raises is to what degree did Pakistan have some knowledge that something was going on in this town, you know, less than an hour away from Islamabad, where this huge fortress went up in an area that essentially belonged to the military. There were restricted zones all over the place. The Pakistani West Point, the military academy, was located there. Retired generals have made their home there. So when you look at Al-Qaeda copycat organizations in various parts of the world, Yemen, Somalia, North Africa, I think business will go on as usual, but the movement has lost its icon. They've lost the leader that they pledged support to, that they pledged fealty to. And I think on that level of recruitment, there's a possibility that without bin Laden, it's going to be much more difficult.
Mel Goodman, what, if anything, you think will change in Afghanistan, given that certainly the initial rationale for launching the war in Afghanistan was the presence of Al-Qaeda in that country? More recently, the military has told us there are very few Al-Qaeda operatives in Afghanistan. Does that rationale still stand up?
I think this should be an opportunity to question what we're doing in Afghanistan. I think we've come to the conclusion that there can be no military solution to the Afghan problem. And we also know and have known for a long time that there are very few members of Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan in any event. The CIA director says there are fewer than 50. The head of the military operation, General David Petraeus, has used the same number, said maybe a little more than 50, but this is a totally insignificant number and doesn't command the presence of 100,000 U.S. troops. And when I think back to December of 2009, when Obama announced the huge increase in forces up to another 33,000, taking us over 100,000, he seemed extremely ambivalent. Well, if that ambivalence was real, and I think it was, I think he should hold firm to his commitment to start withdrawing troops in the summer, as he said he would. And this will be a real test, not only of Obama's relationship with the military and with the Pentagon, but his commitment to adhere to a policy that he put into effect in 2009 and even had a statement signed by all the major players in the room that they understood the policy, that we were going to begin withdrawal in the summer of 2011. But we have commitments that the U.S. would be getting out of Iraq, and now you have a Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, who's saying that if Iraqis want us to stay, we'll remain in Iraq for a longer period of time. So this is a testing point for Obama, and it comes at a very difficult time because he's changed his own national security team and I think made it much weaker.
Mel Goodman, I wanted to ask you about, what do you think the effect will be of bin Laden's death alongside this very unexpected set of uprisings across the Middle East and North Africa challenging U.S.-supported dictators and monarchies? Do you think Al-Qaeda and these other jihadi groups have lost a lot of support that they once had in the Arab world?
Well, there's no question they've lost support, but frankly, I think the loss of support began on 9/11. 9/11 was a classic case of overreaching. They scored a great surprise and had a great success and had great euphoria over what they did on 9/11. But the fact of the matter was that's when the movement went into decline. And if you look at the terrorist operations that have taken place since 9/11, they are bizarre kinds of situations in terms of Robert Reed and the shoe bomber, Abdul Muttalib from Nigeria, and the underwear bomber. They don't seem to be recruiting the kinds of people they had in the past. And I don't see any Arab societies that are showing any grief for the loss of bin Laden. I think he was a marginal character to begin with, who then marginalized himself further on 9/11. And I think what the Arab Spring proved in terms of the series of revolutions which caught, I think, the American policy and intelligence community by surprise, certainly caught bin Laden by surprise and made it clear that he wasn't a major instrument of influence in the Middle East, that he didn't really count for that much. And what the masses wanted in the Middle East had nothing to do with bin Laden or Islamic politics. It wasn't anti-U.S. It wasn't anti-Israel. These people were fighting for basic rights and clear democratic reform. So I think the situation was changing and unfolding in a way where Al-Qaeda was essentially irrelevant.
That was Mel Goodman, a former CIA analyst and senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. His forthcoming book is titled National Insecurity: The Threat of American Militarism. Find links to Goodman's recent articles on our website at btlonline.org.
Pakistan, Sunday. U.S. troops cornered and killed Osama bin Laden just 40 miles outside Islamabad in a mansion. President Obama claims he was killed after a firefight, which sounds to me like cops saying someone was killed while resisting arrest. It is impossible to determine from this statement or any subsequent reports if Osama bin Laden fought to the death or was executed on the spot. His bodyguards fought back, according to the U.S. military, but bin Laden himself was somehow caught unarmed. Certainly a trial would have offered Obama an ugly choice between a circus trial in New York and a military commission before an internationally condemned kangaroo court at Guantanamo Bay. The U.S. should now withdraw from Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iraq. They killed the man they went to war to catch. Meanwhile, the fighting goes on, and it will continue so long as U.S. troops continue to occupy other people's countries. Afghanistan, Monday. A suicide bomber attacked a joint patrol of NATO and Afghan forces in southern Afghanistan, killing one policeman but no foreign troops, who were presumably better armored and screened by Afghan government soldiers and police. Pakistan, Tuesday. Four oil tank trucks serving the occupation troops in Afghanistan were blown up by insurgents. One was destroyed near Ali Mosque, three more near the Torkham border and the Khyber Pass in Afghanistan. The Abdullah Azam Brigade, a local Taliban faction, took credit for the latter attack. Basra, Iraq, yesterday. The U.S. base at Basra Airport was hit by five Katyusha rockets, causing no human casualties. Taji, Iraq, yesterday. Taji Camp, another occupation base, was hit by mortar shells with unreported results. Iraq, ongoing. Protesters are absolutely demanding that the U.S. honor the December 31st deadline to leave the country, or else. Muqtada al-Sadr has vowed that his Mahdi army will take up arms and return to the battlefield if U.S. troops are still present in January. Mr. Barack Obama, you caught and killed bin Laden. The U.S. got what it came for in Afghanistan. Soldiers will be asking, can we go home now? The people of Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iraq are asking, can you go home now? Now's the time to declare victory and bring all the troops home from all three countries today.
And no amount of money you could give me, honey, couldn't pay me, ain't going back again. I ain't going back again. I ain't going back again. You won't see me back there again. No, you won't see me back there again.
On the 30th of April, Rupert Murdoch, the infamous Lord of Fox News, showed up at the White House Correspondents' Dinner and was pursued by a small band of rebels from Code Pink.
Rupert Murdoch!
The Asian lady!
She's Rupert! Rupert! Rupert Murdoch! get him!
Go, go, go! Those army recruiting ads had to have side effect warnings like drug advertisements on TV do.
The United States Army may not be right for every patient. Side effects can include distress, disillusionment, bitter resentment, isolation, traumatic and post-traumatic stress, sociopathic behavior, uncontrollable sobbing, uncontrollable violence, prosecutions for war crimes, prosecutions for domestic crimes, loss of contact with loved ones, loss of ability to love, brain injuries, blindness, depleted uranium poisoning, flashbacks, horror of death, horror of being away from death, loss of the use of limbs, loss of limbs, death, suicide, excruciating pain, the desire to feel excruciating pain, overwhelming rage and misery, loss of hearing, punishment by the Army for failure to obey illegal orders, punishment by courts of law or by enemy forces for obeying illegal orders, torture, humiliation, shame, dangerous habits of blind subservience, or the wasting of what could have been the best years of your life. If you experience any of these symptoms, deal with it, sucker. You already signed your name on the dotted line.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. WSQT Radio at hushmail.com.
Head rock, Jared Ball, DJ Munch, Chocolate City, this is movement music.
Have you heard the news?
Walmart's coming,
coming. Georgia Avenue, uptown, ain't that something?
Something.
Small businesses, shop owners, hearts pumping, cause they know their livelihoods is about to take a thumping.
Thumping.
See, you can't compete with a superstore who's an importer of slave laborers. Craftsmanship, low price to flip, to undercut the market, hand over fist.
Walmart
is infamous for the way they behave. Low wage pay, treat the workers like slaves. Employees who try to unionize, soon find themselves in unemployment lines. The way they treat women needs improving. 1.6 million sisters are suing them for being paid less than the male equivalent. On these issues and more,
we can't afford to be ignorant.
Keep DC Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me. They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about Chocolate City unity. Opportunists out to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
This is the Funkinest Journalist with your three Walmart commandments. Step one, move in and crush competition by underselling. Step two, pay workers nothing and block unionization. Step three, take all that money, put it into the Walton Family Foundation, and turn that into political influence to protect yourself and make even more.
Walmart, it's not a good fit for Chocolate City. Let me holler black at you with the skinny. Important that you clearly understand and remember, DC doesn't work with the right wing agenda. The Walton families are big contributors to bigoted representatives and senators. Trent Lott, sinister, Strom Thurmond, similar, Confederate, state loving George Bush ministers. O oversee a plantation mentality. Results in black and brown casualties. Statehood opposition for the district has been supported by Walmart's mischief. The D.C. Voting Rights Act was defeated, assisted via Walmart PACs, and now they wanna come here to see their money stack. Stay up on the facts. Chocolate City, don't relax and fight back.
Keep D.C. Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me. They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about Chocolate City unity. Opportunist out to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
Keep D.C. Walmart free is an emerging activist group of D.C. residents stepping up to challenge the corporate big box invasion of Chocolate City. Walmart has plans to establish 4 stores in D.C. by 2012. Walmarts in D.C. will threaten small businesses, cause loss of more jobs than it will bring to the community, and lower the wage standards for all workers. To find out more and get involved, visit walmartfreedc.org.
4th of May, representatives of Walmart and their wannabe developer Folger Pratt. It's been a tough night of ducking questions and dancing around the District Department of Transportation's rejection of their traffic study.
If you can summarize in 3 sentences what the D.C. Department of Transportation report just said, I don't think everybody...
I can do it in maybe 2 sentences. Basically, what it says is that in DDOT's measured opinion as transportation professionals, not enough information was provided for them to accurately gauge the impact of this store on the transportation infrastructure, transit, and they really think that because it's an urban setting, the metrics used in their study aren't appropriate or accurate and probably undercount the number of trips generated in a significant way.
Intersection.
Could you identify yourself?
Willie Baker. Baker, B-A-K-E-R. Here's the intersection. How many additional cars are going to be coming here and here in the course of the day?
Georgia and Missouri.
Your count, your guy who's on the corner counting cars, what's the additional?
I can look in the study right now, but I don't know that off the top of my head.
You didn't submit that?
Oh. We did. It's right here. I can look it up for you.
Give me the number.
The problems currently with that intersection. That intersection has been failing or at a level of service D, according to this report, for quite some time. Our responsibility is to mitigate the additional traffic, not come in and rework the geometry to make that intersection work.
You wouldn't build on top of a faulty foundation, would you? If you knew the foundation was faulty, you wouldn't put an addition on it, would you? I mean, I didn't mean to interrupt, but that statement made no sense. There's an inherent problem with that intersection. You know that there's an inherent problem with that intersection.
I'm just saying
the pure logic of building an addition on your home with a faulty foundation doesn't make sense. And I see this is doing the same thing.
Would you tell me how many additional cars come through this intersection?
I will look it up.
Tell us now. I don't want you to leave without telling us. Tell us how many. Please tell us how many additional cars you said are coming through here.
Why don't you keep going? We can go on to the next question. I promise you we will not let him leave without that.
It must have taken half an hour for Walmart Community Affairs Director Keith Morris to answer the question by reading out a claim that it would only be about 450 cars from the very study that DDOT threw out as flawed, said it underestimated the amount of trips Walmart would generate. In the meantime, it went on to answer other questions, like this one, in which a right-wing, conservative, presumably yuppie veteran insulted African-American neighborhoods like the one threatened by Walmart.
Property values more, what gives greater incidence to crime and vagrancy, prostitution, and drug use than an empty lot. My point is, Curtis Chevrolet...
I am in the neighborhood that is directly affected by the proposed Walmart. We are totally, absolutely against a Walmart in that location. In regard to the empty lot, it is always interesting for me, whenever there's a comment about a predominantly black neighborhood, that we always find derogatory terms in which to describe these communities. The Curtis Chevrolet site is a site that needs development. We want it developed. We want the white development there. There has been no instance of prostitution. There has been no increased crime. I live in the neighborhood. It's a very quiet neighborhood. It does not have a lot of traffic. There are nice, well-kept homes. We have a community not unlike communities on the other side of Rock Creek Park, commonly referred to as Western Park. We want to keep that community. We don't want a big box store like Walmart. The neighborhood cannot absorb it. It is not personally against you, Walmart. However, we will not accept you. And you do have some things that are going. There's a class action lawsuit against Walmart, predominantly people of color, because wages, because of hiring and firing practices. You do not have a good record. So when you answer, you sort of skate what is real. You don't give the full truth. There have been studies. There's a long-term effect, negative effect, of what Walmart does when it comes into a community. And these are academic studies that are not based on emotional input, but strictly information that has been gathered. You have nowhere to go in this country. You have saturated the country. You have put these communities out. You've killed communities. And you have nowhere else to go in the United States. So therefore, the only place you can go except abroad is to go into urban areas. There is no dearth of fresh fruits and vegetables in the area in which we live. We certainly would welcome some very nice input, but there's no reason for you to come in saying that we don't have access to grocery stores. We do. We have access to grocery stores. So we are a great community. We want to stay a great community. We want our children and grandchildren to enjoy communities growing in a very positive way, just the way that Folger Pratt and you, Walmart, would want your children and grandchildren to inherit. We don't want you here.
I have so many things to say. I don't really know where to start. And one is that I grew up in Mississippi in several different towns, and I saw those towns utterly devastated by Walmart moving in. There was no room for competition. I mean, it just ate the town. So I just wanted to say that. But is there anything that we can say to the two of you that will make you abandon this project?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say to that, I understand the concern. There's been a lot of passionate people that spoke here, and it's because you live in the ward and have been long-term residents in the ward. But you have to understand, too, that not to demand.
Blah, 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 blah. Walmart. Always low wages.
Remember that attempt to close the West End Library in 2007? The one where the required public hearing was held on the 5th of July, the day after the fireworks? Well, those fat pigs at East Bank have once again pushed legislation through the city council to let them close the library and build condos on the site, hopefully to include a new library in the end. Here's a sample of our own radio coverage of what happened last time after a second public hearing.
This is Dial Tone for WSQT Radio. Library closing alert. The city council has passed legislation to sell the West End Library to East Bank, the same corporation that finances development in Georgetown. On Saturday, July 14, 2007, Joe Sternley, vice president of acquisition for East Bank, came to speak to the library. He was met with a crowd that had just been pumped up by an energetic rally outside, put together by Empower DC's People's Property Campaign, as well as some friends of the library.
Yeah, sir.
if indeed East Bank is does not want to be secretive, then I take that to mean East Bank is for good government. As a member of this community, I insist upon a competitive bidding of ideas for this library site. And
now, with Fendi and the unwelcome spotlight he attracted gone, those fat slugs at East Bank think they can force the community to accept the closure of yet another library. Some community groups have given up and are settling for attempts to get concessions out of the deal. How about East Bank paying taxes to the city in excess of all that taxpayer money they will get to tear down a perfectly good library so they can sell condos for profit? How about we kick the rich off welfare and keep our libraries open?
New Mexico community activist Arturo Uribe worked to blow the whistle on pollution from a fertilizer plant that was harming the lives of children in the mostly Latino town of Mesquite, New Mexico. The company sued Uribe to shut him up. Uribe first noticed pollution coming from the fertilizer processing plant owned by Helena Chemical Company when his newborn baby had respiratory problems. The baby boy needed a nebulizer to clear his lungs. Uribe also complained to the New Mexico Environmental Department about fumes coming from the plant. State environmental inspectors eventually levied over $200,000 in civil fines against Helena for violations of air quality laws. The agency also fined Helena for failing to report the spill of 500 gallons of liquid fertilizer. After filing a lawsuit against Helena for its emissions that he claimed harmed children, the company sued Uribe for defamation and harassing its employees. Helena used the civil suit to search Uribe's computers, email records, and digital photographs. In April 2010, Helena won its defamation suit against Uribe, and the judge ordered the activist to pay $75,000 in damages to the company. The damages were later reduced, and Uribe has appealed. Uribe's lawyer, Linda Thomas, told the Progressive magazine, "This decision is going to have a chilling effect on anyone in this country who wants to stop polluters in their community."
Now listen up, you slap-suing bastards. Listen up, corporations. Listen good, Walmart. Listen good, McDonald's. You may think you can sue activists to shut them up, but I got news for you. If you try to do the same thing to me, here's what you'll find. My computers are encrypted. You cannot search them. I will not comply with a subpoena for the passwords. I will not cooperate with your attack. Even if you win in court, you will never collect a penny. I have no wages. I have no assets. You will be squeezing blood from a turnip, and you will get nothing but a fistful of legal bills. Bring it on, you blood-sucking corporate pigs. 26th of April, animal rights protesters returned to the D.C. offices of Nomura, an investment firm holding stock in Fortress, the investor that bailed out puppy-killing Huntington Life Sciences with over $100 million in loans. Without Fortress, Huntington Life Sciences would be bankrupt today, and 500 animals a day would no longer be killed testing things like Fleach and Splenda. The protests are starting to bite, but instead of dumping Fortress, security guards at Nomura assaulted protesters trying to break somebody's ankle and smashed a bullhorn on the 26th of April. Here's an interview with a protester who was assaulted.
What happened with the security guard assault at Nomura at the Huntington Life Sciences protest?
We arrived at Nomura just like we normally do. We made it inside the lobby when we felt that our message was adequately served and got the attention of everyone else. We exited the building, and as another employee was going in, we just went up to the doors a little bit with the bullhorns and everything, and we ended up, the security closed the door and locked it really fast, and we went around to the other entrances. During the course of the thing, the security guard actually charged out of the door, grabbed an activist bullhorn, threw it to the ground after trying to literally stomp and looked like the intent was to break the ankle of myself.
And this was on the street, not inside the building?
We were just about 5 feet from the doorway.
Outside the building, though, right?
Outside the building.
Not inside his building, and he tries to break somebody's leg and destroy equipment.
Yes.
That is strong-arm robbery and assault.
Yeah, and unfortunately we didn't have a video camera to get all of that on footage, but it seems that the security is getting increasingly annoyed at the protest. We made it clear to them that we're never backing down until they completely divest from Fortress and Fortress actually pull the loans from and provides proof of pulling the loans.
Maybe they ought to be annoyed at Fortress for bringing them all this trouble.
The what?
Maybe they ought to be annoyed at Fortress for bringing them all this trouble, or maybe their insurance company ought to be annoyed with them for exposing them to potential liability for medical expenses.
Exactly.
You know, you realize if you're having any trouble with that ankle at all, you could go to a doctor, have it looked at, and send the bill to Nomura.
I probably should. I mean, I was limping all day, and it's still, you know, when I move it in a certain direction, it's still, you know, hurts a little bit.
Have it looked at and send the bill to Nomura. They're the ones that inflicted the injury. Under the laws of civil liability, they're the ones that have to pay.
Yes, that's probably a good idea.
Call up the lawyer about that, and let's see what we can do.
Yeah, sounds good.
Now, Nomura, I've heard of lots of ways that investors would lose their shirt with Huntington Life Sciences and with Fortress, but that's a new one. Assaulting protesters and exposing yourself to possible lawsuits.
The March 11th Japanese earthquake and tsunami that killed 14,700 people and left an estimated 11,000 missing also destroyed the Fukushima nuclear power plant complex in the north of the country. On April 21st, the Japanese government evacuated residents living within a 20-kilometer radius of the disabled nuclear complex and barred them from returning to their homes due to increased levels of radiation. Utility workers have been struggling to repair the cooling systems of Fukushima's three stricken reactors, but high levels of radiation have prevented workers from entering the reactor buildings. But in recent days, fans with filters are being deployed to reduce radiation levels inside the reactor buildings necessary to allow repair crews to begin their work. Officials of the Tokyo Electric Power Company, or TEPCO, which owns the Fukushima complex, has said it may take the rest of the year to regain control of the broken reactors. Open displays of dissent within the Japanese government are rare, but that changed on April 30th when senior nuclear advisor Toshiso Kosako, a professor at the University of Tokyo's graduate school, held a press conference to resign his post over his disagreement with the government's level of allowable radiation exposure. Kosako quit in protest over the government's April 19th decision to set the annual radiation limit at 20 millisieverts per year for infants, toddlers, and primary school students. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Dr. Michio Kaku, theoretical physicist and author, who is a professor at the City College of New York. Dr. Kaku assesses the ongoing health threat from the disaster at the failed Fukushima nuclear reactors and the debate over the government's annual allowable radiation limits.
The reactors, they say, are stable, but I think of them as a ticking time bomb, which is also relatively stable. And they figure that in 6 to 9 months, in the best-case scenario, they'll be able to relieve the brave firemen who are shooting hose water, into these nuclear power plants, keeping them safe. And in 6 to 9 months, automatic pumps will be turned on to relieve these heroic firemen who are like samurai warriors. Some of them are not going to come back alive. Radiation levels are huge at the site, lethal, in fact, in some areas. In about 1 hour, you get the radiation sickness, in fact. You start to vomit, your hair falls out. You have premature aging and death within a few hours. That's how lethal the radiation field is. And then Hitachi Corporation says, in a best-case scenario, 30 years to complete the dismantling of the melted cores and seal the whole thing in concrete. That's the best-case scenario. The worst-case scenario is that we have another small earthquake. Now, remember, we're going to have secondary earthquakes for another year. And if they have to evacuate the firemen and the crew on site, then there's no more cooling water to keep the reactors cool, and then the meltdown starts all over again.
In terms of low-level radiation, which is a growing concern in Japan and around the world, there's somewhat of a debate. You hear many officials and utility power company people around the world, certainly in Japan, reassuring the public that low levels of radiation are not really a problem. But of course, there are many different opinions. And a senior nuclear advisor to the Japanese Prime Minister, Naoto Kan, resigned, saying the government radiation limits would not protect school children living in northern Japan, nor did he approve of increasing the rates that workers on site at Fukushima could absorb.
The reason why this gentleman quit, which is unprecedented, by the way, these panels are usually rubber-stamped panels that agree with the government. They're like a bunch of yes-men. So for him to actually quit and denounce the utility and the government plans is quite extraordinary. And he basically said that children will be getting the same radiation dose as atomic workers. And atomic workers, in turn, get many times the dose that an ordinary adult gets. And he said that this is unconscionable. Now, the reason why the government and the utility went along with this recommendation, of course, is because of money. Right now, the cleanup costs are around $300 billion, making it the most expensive natural disaster in history. And if they have to keep on expanding the evacuation zone, then, of course, it's going to cost more money to resettle these people and pay for property damage. But my attitude is, think of the much larger economic impact you're going to have if these people come down with cancer. They're going to sue the government, and there are going to be a lot of epidemiologists who will back their lawsuit when these people begin to come down with leukemia in 5 years and solid tumors in 10 to 15 years. There are going to be a lot of lawsuits from these kids and unnecessary cancers. The utility has a long history of cover-ups. In fact, there was a huge cover-up that took place about 10 years ago, a very, very bad accident that was completely covered up by the utility. You have to remember that the utility made a fatal mistake. They did not take into account the 100-year storm, as we call it, tsunamis that take place on a scale of 100 years. The walls at the reactor site were 15 feet tall. The tsunami that hit that wall was 45 feet tall, overwhelmed the reactor, and then the generators and backup pumps were put in the basement. I can't think of anything sillier than putting the backup pumps and the fail-safe system in the basement of a nuclear power plant. So all the safety systems got knocked out in the opening minutes of the accident. And that's why all three cores went into a partial meltdown mode within hours of that. And in fact, Unit 2 probably has a breach of containment. Now, if you look at Chernobyl as an example, the dead zone around Chernobyl is about 19 miles in radius, and that area is still radioactive. In fact, if you die of radiation poisoning, your grave will be radioactive for centuries, even though you're long gone and dead. Your gravesite will be radioactive. And so the dead zone is incredible around Chernobyl. In Japan, 10% of the radiation of Chernobyl came out, so the dead zone will be smaller. But still, we're talking about the loss of livelihood. The economic area is going to be totally devastated. Who's going to want to live right next to that area? Who's going to want to buy a product that comes from that area?
That was Dr. Michio Kaku, theoretical physicist, co-founder of string field theory, and a professor at the City College of New York. His newest book is titled Physics of the Future. Visit our website to find links to Dr. Kaku's latest articles and other information on the Fukushima disaster at btlonline.org.
25 years after the Chernobyl nuclear accident, high levels of radiation are still leaking out of the damaged power plant. According to the Interpress service, the cement and steel sarcophagus built to encase the nuclear reactor has cracks and is leaking radiation at unsafe levels. A new sarcophagus to contain the damaged reactor is scheduled to be completed in 2015. It will cost a projected $2.3 billion to complete. So far, only $880 million from donors has been raised. A new health study by the German affiliate of International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War estimates the nuclear accident at Chernobyl led to the death of 112,000 cleanup workers, first responders, and soldiers who tried to contain the radioactive damage. The explosion at Chernobyl's Unit 4 on April 26, 1986, led to the release of 8 tons of nuclear material that spewed across Europe, The radioactive cloud was 500 times more toxic than the atomic bomb at Hiroshima. The World Health Organization estimates that in Belarus alone, 50,000 children suffered from thyroid cancer. Globally, the United Nations projected that the Chernobyl nuclear accident caused between 30,000 and 210,000 children to be born with genetic defects.